Catch new episodes of Dial the Gate weekends at youtube.com/dialthegate. And for the latest schedule, visit dialthegate.com. Hello, welcome to episode 236 of Dial the Gate, the Stargate Oral History Project. My name is David Reed. This is the penultimate episode of season three, and we have Heather E. Ash, writer and story editor for Stargate SG-1. Really excited about this one. Before we bring Heather in, if you enjoy Stargate and you want to see more content like this on YouTube, click the like button. It makes a difference with YouTube and will continue to help the show grow its audience. And please also consider sharing this video with a Stargate friend. And if you want to get notified about future episodes, click the subscribe icon. And giving the bell icon a click will notify you the moment a new video drops, and you'll get my notifications of any last-minute guest changes. And clips from this live stream will be released over the course of the next few weeks on both the Dial the Gate and GateWorld.net YouTube channels. As this is a live show, my moderators are standing by in the YouTube live chat to take questions for Heather. They will get them over to me, and I will get them over to her. So if you have questions about her episodes or her career or just her as a person, go ahead and submit those questions, and I will review them. In the meantime, Heather E. Ash, writer and story editor for Stargate SG-1, is with me. Heather, this has been a long time coming. I have been looking forward to this, and I am privileged to have you.
You're so sweet. Thanks, David. I'm thrilled to be here.
How are you doing? How are things going?
Things are good.
Things are good.
It turned winter all of a sudden here in the Midwest. So
I know. So you're in Chicago.
Chicago area. Yeah.
Oh, man. So I love Chicago winters, and people think that I'm crazy.
Nope. I love them too.
See, there you go. So yes. What's going on these days? What are you working on?
A lot of different things, I think. I've always been someone with multiple interests all at the same time. Blessing and a curse. Actually, yes. My paid job is being a math coach, similar to a math tutor.
Okay.
But it's more getting into the mindset of what keeps us from math. And that came about when I was going back to be a teacher, discovering that math was actually understandable and cool. Sorry, go ahead.
What keeps us from math? I'm curious. If you could delineate that into one idea, what keeps us from math? Because I would love to know, because I hated doing math, but once I got it, I got it.
So the biggest obstacle, I think, and I used to be this person, because I never took math after high school. I was going to be a screenwriter. Who cares? You know, I don't need the math. And I think the thing that keeps us from it is just thinking we're bad at it, and society, or at least American society, accepting that that's okay to say. It's okay to be bad at math, but no one says I'm bad at reading or I'm bad at walking. You know, that always inspires, like, we should fix that. But bad at math is fine.
Okay, so you cracked the code is what you're saying.
Part of it, I think.
Okay, so it's just a matter of pep talks.
I think it's more a matter of psychology.
Okay.
And just kind of like identifying your panic, identifying the reasons that you're fearing pursuing this thing, and letting yourself fail.
Wow.
And being comfortable with failure, because that's okay.
Yeah.
And that was the lesson long time coming. Stems out of writing, I think.
Yeah.
Going back to being a writer. And I use a lot of those narrative skills too, that I developed as a writer and as an artist, and I'm still writing. I just don't do it for money or for television at this point.
Okay.
But getting back to the reason why I loved writing, which is telling a story and making something make sense for myself or for someone else. So I'm going to do a lot of my math explanations within like a greater narrative, because I think you learn it easier if it's not just step by step, but like the Superman method of solving an algebraic equation.
Okay. Well, that's that makes a lot of sense. You know, I think that a lot of our fears are allowed to kind of, we kind of let them pull us down and just make us, you know, these people that we don't necessarily want to be, but we just let them keep us where we are. And I had that, it's interesting, I had that problem with math myself, but in college I finally realized that I could do it with the right guide. So wow, okay, yeah. That's interesting. Wow,
it's fun.
Yeah. Can you tell me how you when you really realized that this is what you wanted to do was to write professionally, at least for...
Yeah, I was like, math? No.
Yeah.
This is about Stargate. Let's get back
yeah,
to...
Yeah, how did you know? When did you realize you wanted to write professionally?
I think since at least first grade.
Okay.
My teacher, Mrs. Pekala, had me writing Raggedy Ann novels, short okay. stories. So I guess my first fan fiction was Raggedy Ann. I just remember being completely bored in first grade and sitting there and imagining Wonder Woman was going to walk in the door and then we would go off and have adventures.
How old are you?
In first grade, I was six.
Aww.
I was six. Yes. And that just kind of continued. So ironically, during math class in high school, I was not actually paying attention to the math. I was writing 21 Jump Street fan fiction. But it looked like I was taking notes, so no one bugged me about it.
Interesting Peter DeLuise connection there. All
Isn't
right.
It?
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
I'm getting
yes,
it.
Yes, there was.
You know, I think that our strongest, at least for me, you know, my strongest, how do I want, imagination thoughts would kick in around, you know, first or second grade and be, you know, playing with the Power Rangers or whatever. So I think that's cool that, you know, you were really starting to get into that even at that early in your life. Which writers did you lean on in terms of, you know, wanting to emulate? So obviously there's a 21 Jump Street background there a little bit. So who else?
I think Madeleine L'Engle was my first.
Okay.
I didn't really have a concept of writers. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this wasn't a career path. Certainly not TV writing. Not until I got to, I think, the middle of high school did I realize that you could write for TV and movies.
Yes.
But Madeleine L'Engle, A Wrinkle in Time, I think was the first time I thought, oh, this is the person who wrote a book. But I didn't understand she'd written sequels. So I was going to write her sequel for her.
Well, that's I think where a lot of us start. It's like, you know, I want to continue what I love.
Absolutely.
And what's copyright? I don't know what copyright is. So,
well, yeah, that's what I think we have fan fiction now online. Yeah. Before the internet, I would trade it with friends. You know, the things that were interesting or the pen pal lists in the back of comic books. Like it was definitely there pre-internet, which we kind of remember that time. But some writers that I admire now who are science fiction writers, someone I know told me that she had been a huge Sam and Jack shipper when I was writing on Stargate and had really had hopes for Beneath the Surface. So I sent her the writer's draft that had, you know, the kissing part that was in the writer's draft as a little thank you. So, I mean, we're all inspired by each other's work, I think. And certainly I love The Twilight Zone, Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, just all of the possibility, all of the... Ironically, I was not allowed to watch a lot of TV when I was younger. So that's one good way to make sure your kid becomes a TV writer is restrict it.
That's exactly right. Boy, do I agree with that. Man, oh man.
Yeah, that's how it happened. But mostly a TV. So people are surprised that my sci-fi, my literary background is not that expansive, but a lot of my influence in sci-fi came from TV and movies.
Wow. Okay. How did you break into the industry? You know, this is And as a woman, I'd love to hear your perspective in terms of some of the trials and tribulations and successes that were yours.
So it was I think I was a 10-year overnight success. I moved there right after college, and I had gone to Northwestern to study radio, TV, film. So I ended up getting to use my degree, and that's pretty cool.
Yep.
There is something called the the NU Mafia in Los Angeles, still going on today. So if you're from Chicago or from Northwestern, you kind of have an in a lot of places with fellow alumni. So that really did open a lot of doors for me in terms of jobs. I got my first job 2 days after I landed working in an accounting firm as an assistant because I went to a Chicagoans in LA breakfast. So networking definitely helped. I turned down a full-time gig there so I could go work in a former agent's production office.
Wow.
Compliments of another Chicagoan who had met me. And then it was writing specs. I had a writer's group, and that was fantastic. The five of us met every week. We were kind of like a writer's room. I was working for other TV shows. I actually got to work for Bill Nuss, who was one of the executive producers of 21 Jump Street. So it's really kind of funny how all that fan fiction, 21 Jump Street kind of keeps coming back to it, which is very odd, but kind of funny. So I had gone to work for as a writer's assistant for Pacific Blue, which is a show that was on USA Network back in the day. You can see me as a chicken in one of the episodes. I lost a bet, so they made me a chicken on screen.
I will seek this out.
Don't you, though? Should be fun. I'm terrible on screen. Don't ever put me in acting. I think I cost them a lot of money that day because I didn't know how to be on camera, and I kept wandering out of frame.
I am a writer.
Reason I lost this bet.
Oh, that's funny.
And yeah, just writing, and I was working for John Sacred Young, who created China Beach and other shows. He was working as an independent writer producer, and that was when I had won a contest with two of my specs, an Outer Limits. And what else? Oh, a Party of Five. And they, as a result of the contest, the prize was you've got to be read or meet all these different writers and agents and producers. So I was going around having lunch with people, and I believe it was Kathy White, possibly, who introduced me to Tony Optikin at MGM. And he read my stuff and he said, "Would you like to pitch to Stargate?"
Wow. So it started in season two, season three at this point?
I want to say it was, so let's see. I started there in March, so it was probably fall of season two.
Okay.
I think. And when I would have, no, that, yeah, thereabouts. I mean, it was over the course of several months. It certainly wasn't an overnight thing. It was meeting with Tony and giving him some pitches. And then it was meeting with the guys and pitching some things. And then it was like going to Outline, I think. By that time, I had gotten an agent because no one would sign me until I started to get the calls from, you know, "Hey, I've got this job coming up." And then everyone wants to meet.
Oh, of course. It's the chicken and the egg.
Exactly.
You know, it's you can't. Until you're in. And then it's like, oh, okay. Well, thanks, guys.
You're real.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. By the time I got to, I'm meeting with them and maybe they'll hire me for something, I pitched what was Learning Curve and they bought the idea.
Got it. So Learning Curve was the start.
Learning Curve was the start.
Learning Curve is what I would say is one of the quintessential Stargate episodes.
I was wondering which one it was.
Yes, because I mentioned this. Like, if I was to sit down with someone and show them what a typical Stargate episode is, I'd show them Window of Opportunity somewhere in there because it's the most fun and, you know, it hits all the notes. It's poignant, you know, it's funny, it's deep. But in terms of a sci-fi morality play, Learning Curve is in my top three, maybe, or four of the show because it is a simple story about protecting what is the most innocent and us wanting to do something to protect people who You know, we think that they're doing what? She's going back to get her brain sucked out. You know, and I dare anyone to say it more lightly. You know, that's always like stuck with me because it's, I just love this story and I loved the acting in it and I loved, you know, the ending. Can you tell me about, so you came to the production office and that was your first, can you tell me about that process?
Yes.
And that story? I've been waiting to hear this.
This was, so by the time I pitched that story and then they wanted an outline, by guild rules and it was a WGC, it's not WGA. So yeah. That was WGC, but, and they're not going to violate guild rules. They had asked me to go to outline and I'd sent them an outline. I think it was like 3 weeks maybe of my proposal for what the scenes would be. My agent called me that night. I was, production hours are long in Hollywood. So it was nighttime in LA. I was still at work and I got a call from my agent that said, they're going to pay you for an outline. And then he said, hold on. And then he came back on the line a couple of minutes later and said, you know what? They're actually going to send you to script just off the bat. And here's how much they're going to pay you. Here's what guild minimum is. And guild minimum is very nice. That's a huge chunk of change. And one of my favorite memories is calling my mom directly after that and saying, hey, guess how much I'm going to get paid for this script? And she started hyperventilating from joy, just, you know, like, hey, I did this thing. But I wrote the script. I wrote the script on my way to work because it was like an hour and a half to work every day in LA traffic. So I wrote a lot of it with a notepad on my lap.
While you're stuck in parking lot traffic.
While I am driving in Laurel Canyon, but I wasn't going very fast.
No, so you don't.
No. And in film school, you learn to write without looking because, you know, you're in the dark. So that helps. But I wrote the script. My writer's group did kind of give me notes on it. I did give it to them and they didn't really watch the show, but they gave me some notes, but it wasn't really intense. I mean, they didn't know the show. And I sent it in to the guys and I got a call back and they had some questions and I addressed the notes. And then I was told, hey, they want to bring you on staff. And I said, cool. And then I did some research because you've all heard about Hollywood being full of egocentric and troublesome people. And I had worked for several of them by that time. And I really didn't want to fly up to Vancouver because it meant I would have to leave LA and move to Vancouver to be on staff.
Yeah.
And so I asked that they fly me up so we could all meet each other and make sure we liked each other. And they did. And it was really nice. I was on a plane 2 weeks later.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a little nuts.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's to be absolutely, man, I can't imagine. Yeah, you're moving to another country for work now.
and I was shocked. I had not been overseas before. So Canada, like Vancouver, yes, they speak English. I mean, this isn't a total different culture, but still it was a bit of a culture shock.
Had you been? Oh, so you hadn't been to Canada yet?
I hadn't been out of the U.S. No, actually, that's not true. I'd been to Canada once. Like, we'd gone over the border when I was a kid and come right back.
Okay, so this was your first...
That was foreign country to me. Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, but I mean, it's also... It was great because I had a car to rent. I had temporary housing, but they had me in the hotel until I could find an apartment. I mean, this was nice. I was treated first class. All the way. And I do appreciate that. And since I was single, there was less of the, you got to bring your family up. You've got to,
right.
Cause all the other guys, the four other writers there, one other one was from the US tour and his wife had come with him. But as I was single, I think it was a little bit easier.
Can you tell me about that group at that time? John Glasner, Brad Wright, Tor Valenza, you know, can you tell
Robert
me
Cooper.
Robert Cooper, God, Robert, I'm sorry. Robert, can you tell me about that team at that point and what it was like meshing with them and being in the writer's room and sharing ideas and thoughts? And who did you relate to more and who were you more like, I don't know, That's too wild. I can't do that.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So being a different person back then, because you know, when you're young, you're slightly different. So I was certainly the youngest one on the team. I was the only woman. I don't think I addressed the being the only woman part.
So Catherine Powers wasn't in the room.
Catherine Powers, I think, had left the year before.
Okay.
And they had brought me on to the timing was such that when I arrived, it was right when Learning Curve was going to start film. So that's why it was 2 weeks. They wanted to make sure I could be on set and have that experience. Yeah, it was fantastic.
Wow.
So I don't think it was anything except they wouldn't cuss in front of me. They were trying to be very, I mean, they were, I don't know if it's because Brad's Canadian and John Glasner, also American, and his wife and daughter were up there with him. Mm. John Glasner went to Northwestern as well. Oh. So we bonded over that. And I will tell you that a good way to impress your boss is to quote the first thing he wrote for television from 21 Jump Street, ironically, without even knowing it was his, because that's very impressive. So I guess I was impressive to him.
That's cool.
Brad is very much the, it'll be fine. We still quote him to this day. My mom and I, like, it'll be fine. Don't worry, it'll be fine. And John Glasner was more of the introverted, like, don't bother him when he's writing kind of guy. And Robert was somewhere in between. Tor was, I think, had only been there for about a year or so. He was very sweet. So I think if you wanted to get something approved, it felt safer to go to Brad because he would be very encouraging. John was always very much the whole, we'll pick the idea part, and that's good. You need that. But, you know, I played it safe. I'm a coward when it comes to story ideas. I was that.
You have to make sure that there are no holes in the hull of your ship, you know?
That was a big thing for Foothold, was getting the device. And I realized going through my episodes again, boy, do I like the device. I mean, I'm always looking for a way to just device something. But the Foothold device was definitely something that we had to work through a few times before we made it two different devices, because the one device did not work plot-wise. You could not end a story like, and then we figure out the reason, because Jonathan was always like, if the reason isn't here, you're not going to figure out magically in script. So we need to figure it out in the outline if it's going to work.
Right, exactly. That's the only, I mean, find the issues as quickly as possible, you know? I imagine for time travel, it's even worse, but...
time travel, yeah.
Right. Learning, how different was your original Learning Curve draft to what ended up on the screen?
So this was, I am shocked to say, it went to screen virtually untouched. Yeah, I know, right? Try to follow that up.
Yeah.
It was
for your first script.
My first script they sent it into production pretty much as is. So I was told. And I mean, clearly I have the writer's draft. Yeah, it was remarkable. I mean, I look back, I still love it. It has a place in my heart. There's places where it's slow. TV was much slower back then. So there's things I would nitpick about it, but at the same time, I mean, like that ending with Rick and the actress, a little bit of that was ad lib. Dogs are some of my favorite people. I do.
Purple dogs.
The purple dogs.
Yeah.
I remember watching a cut of that. Brad had given me a cut to take home. So I was watching that in my apartment. And at the end, I just burst into tears. And I went in the next day. I said, I cried. And Brad was so afraid that I hated it. It's like, oh no. I said, no, you don't understand. This was something I wrote and now it's in front of me. Like someone else put it in front of me. And that was an amazing experience.
Wow. When the acting is sincere and the writing is solid, you've got anyone making a sincere effort, you've got a winner. You know? I love that performance. I loved the actress as Marin. We've had her on.
Oh, wow.
And that it's just, it's it shows that some of the more simpler stories can be, in my opinion, the most successful. It doesn't have to be complicated. There doesn't have to be a lot of explosions. And, you know, as a result of that, the Nacrita reactor, came to be. So,
hey, mine was square, I thought.
Yes, it was. That was the Orbanian one. This is the this is the Earth retro-engineered version. So
very cool.
I love the episode, and it's just one of the ones that I always go back to in terms of saying, yeah, this is exemplary, not just Stargate, but sci-fi. You know, there are certain things that are right and wrong, you know, and but then we're faced with a civilization that just doesn't think like we do. And, you know, at what point is that OK? You know, and we have to find that in our hearts, you know, which is, I think, is still wild about the story because they don't see things that way, you know.
Right. And it's like the greater good question. I really like that story. Before I forget, because I want to say something about. It was Brittany who played Marin in that.
Brittany Irvin.
Do remember that I was there for casting. We were seeing the casting tapes come in. And Brittany was, of all the actresses who'd submitted, we were clearly looking for someone who was younger. But because of work rules, you really want to have someone who's over, I think, the age of 12 or 13 so that they can work longer hours. And what we were seeing was a lot of younger girls who were projecting far, far older. So it was tape after tape of, you know, a 13-year-old coming in and having a much older presence to them. And Brittany was, I think, one of the only ones who came in and not only really was fantastic at the performance, but was very much able to play that younger aspect of it, that more innocent aspect of it that role needed. And then having Rick, who's always fantastic at selling the emotion. He's a snarky guy. But what I really loved about this performance was playing into the, he's lost his son. And now how do we plug into that and make it more personal for him?
He's still capable of being a dad. You know?
Yeah, and I think that once you cross that Rubicon, I guess, of parenthood and having done it now, you always kind of have that element of thinking about someone else and their benefit first.
Mm-hmm. Especially if you think that they're being taken advantage of or could be.
Absolutely.
That's wild. Yeah.
Yes. But then again, I mean, the whole knowledge of a planet because your kid got chosen... there's something to that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's just the luck of it. And I think, you know, Joseph Malazzi and I had this conversation a lot. You know, were it written today, were a story written today, a lot of the Stargate, early Stargate episodes would not necessarily have ended so sweetly.
Right.
I do think that that's a product of the late 90s and early 2000s where there was a little bit... Not an eagerness per se, but or a desire per se, but it was okay with tying things up in a nice bow. And I think that that's God forbid for like a series like Black Mirror or something else. God forbid you do that on one or two of them. It's okay to do that every now and then, you know, to actually find a peaceful compromise. You know, what if the Orbanians? What if their brains were broken? You know, what if they just didn't just return to a childlike state? What if they couldn't be taught? I don't think that we would have had the continuing relationship with them that we clearly did throughout the show in getting devices like that one. And
right.
That would have been an interesting approach. Did you consider hitting it that way? Or was
it's
it
so
always they just get
that.
Reduced to a childlike state and can now be taught the old-fashioned way?
Well, she couldn't be taught the old-fashioned way. They were lobotomized by this process.
Okay, so they can't learn...
No.
Okay.
Where we see them is where they are. And
okay.
So possibly, because it was only one scene and, you know, production is expensive.
Yeah.
So perhaps we should have seen the adults. It's interesting because it's been so clear in my mind for so long. It never occurred to me that it wouldn't be clear to everyone else.
Yeah, because
another Brad-ism is if the audience doesn't understand it, you have to make sure that the audience, not for this, but I'm just saying, like, if we're talking tech, you have to make sure your audience can follow along or else you're not doing your job. If I might go TV slash film history for a second, because I've taught that and I love that. The 90s were very nihilistic in terms of film at the time. So if you remember, Seven was coming out then, a lot of snarkiness, a lot of darkness. Just, it's depressing. I watch the 90s films now and I feel like I have to take a shower because it's just so dark.
But oh, God.
TV then, and it was weird too, because it was Showtime. So we were cable, right? When this was on, it was Showtime. So it was more of a, we were supposed to go R-rated. And right now it's very PG, except for that first episode, which I don't think you can find the original one that has all the nudity that Showtime used to have.
Yeah, I think there's like DVDs had them. There were a couple of, but mostly the broadcasts, the syndicated broadcast versions are intact.
When they went to Fox, I think.
Correct.
There was a broadcast version. But TV then was still in the episodic phase. It hadn't yet moved to, we're going to be able to see these past episodes. It was all in reruns. So if you missed something, no one could guarantee that you would know what the backstory was when you dipped into this episode. Mm. So your episodes had to appeal to everyone from the long-term viewer to the first-time viewer. And I think that the happy version was kind of an aspect of that, if that makes sense. And there must have been something in the water, because that was Blue Sky Television on USA Network was very much like, let's be happy in the 90s. I don't remember my history so well, but it just seems that TV was the happier place compared to the movies. And then it kind of, as the movie people moved into TV and TV became more of an artist's platform, and reality set in, like you could do more in television, that maybe it started to change at that point.
That's a really reasonable analysis, I think. That makes a lot of sense to me. It's just they're willing to, and as Stargate went along, you know, you want to tell, I know that everyone hates this word, you want to tell grittier stuff, you know? You can't.
Well, it's funny you say brain sucking, because the Outer Limits that everyone said would never, I couldn't use it as a spec, because no one watched Outer Limits, and no one wants to see that as a spec. And that spec got me all of my jobs, but that had lobotomization in it. It was very gritty. It was very dark, to the point where I would have meetings based on that spec, and I would walk in the room, and people would just do a double take, because I mean, I have not changed much. I'm probably a little more edgy looking now, urban me. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest. I'm very Midwestern. But I would walk in and they'd be like, you are not what we expected.
Good. Like
but it was like, we expected goth. We expected, you know, Doc Martens and all black and black lipstick. And it was just like, hey, how's it going? So, yeah, I mean, it's fun. People worry about me, I guess, like, oh, what's she thinking? She looks so nice. So the joke still among everyone who knows me and my work is like, oh, but there's brain sucking. Is that going to be a feature in all of your episodes?
For sure. What a great story to start with. Absolutely. Foothold. Oh, my gosh. Costumes and, you know, shellfish aliens that do this.
Shellfish aliens. Weren't those great?
They were. I can't imagine, like, I look at that episode and I see, you know, these costumes and these creatures, you know, when you create stuff for television, you almost, you know, hope to be able to, like, use some of this stuff in future episodes. You're creating assets for the show. But to just go out there for one episode where we see all this stuff, and aside from a little device that you can attach to your chest, we don't see any of that again. I'm curious, before we get into the nitty gritty, was it ever an issue of, oh, this is gonna hit the budget? You know, we're gonna have to create a lot of stuff, even though we're not really going off world for this episode. I'm curious, were there any conversations over that?
Not ones I was privy to. Okay. I was story editor level. I mean, it was the plane. I think you've heard the plane story.
I have not heard the plane story from this episode.
There's so many stories. Foothold is my favorite episode.
Okay.
That of all the ones that were written, that was my absolute favorite. Still my favorite.
Okay.
Like, I come back to that one. Because Learning Curve for me is, like, a little slow. Like, I love it, but it's slow to me. It's just, like, I want it to go a little bit more.
It's not action-y.
It's not action-y. And I am a fan of action, not action devoid of character. And and this, I think, really hits what my strengths are, which is some humor, some action, but yet the character is in there. And like I'd said before, that the device aspect of it, we wrestled with a lot. It began with like the Body Snatchers kind of concept. I feel like I'm very derivative as I watch all of my episodes. Like, we've got Body Snatchers, we've got Metropolis, we've got all this stuff. I really like the idea of who can you trust within the SGC? Mm. Like, are people come back and something's not right? And how do we handle that? And sending Sam Carter off the base was a way to get, that's not who she is. She's not, you know, to divide up our people and kind of and make them not trust each other. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? She originally didn't go to Mayborn. She originally went to the guy who was flying the plane, whose name escapes me.
Is it Paul Davis?
Major Davis.
Yeah, because he comes out and he does that.
Yes, he was supposed to be the one she goes to.
Okay.
First. So here's the thing. Let's talk about the fear that keeps you from doing the thing. So for me, you know, first job, you want to do the right thing. And I got really caught up in, let's make this right. I want to make sure that everyone loves it. I want to make sure that, you know, I'm not embarrassing my boss. I want to do a good job. That is kind of paralyzing in the same way that math can be paralyzing. Let's just draw that back.
In terms of it keeps you from action?
It keeps me from taking the swing at the fence. You know what I mean? You want to play it, you play it a little too safe. You play it a little too nice. Instead of going, like, really, let's make everything really uncomfortable. What is the kind of decision you could make here that's really going to be, how are you going to write your way out of it? And so originally I thought, well, she goes to Mayborn. And I second guessed myself. And then as I was talking it over with Brad, and Brad was, he's like, this is not quite working for me. And I said, well, I had this thought that she'd go to Mayborn. And he's like, yes, wait, why didn't you just go there? And so she goes to Mayborn, and that really opened it up a lot. The plane, thank God they were filming. I forgot what they were filming on the lot, but it had been a feature film featuring a 747, and our UPM? John Smith called me and said, hey, could you put a plane in your script?
Could I?
It was great, because otherwise they'd have to come in a van, and then you're not going to see them. It really was a problem in the script. So the timing was fantastic, which is, how do we get them from out there back here? So Sam and O'Neill and everybody. And the plane was really a gift. It was an expensive gift, but then, like you said, it's an asset that they can use over and over for the rest of the show's run. And they can write it off in that budget rather than just have it sitting there. So that's where the plane came in. I think that's why Davis was there, because we wanted to use them. And I know that they really liked the actor too. So we got to keep him. But it was just so much fun. And I know that one of the lines where Carter comes in and is saying, I forgot what the line is, and I should know it, but she's just rattling off technobabble. And she could not get through it.
You mean Amanda?
Amanda could not get through it. And I felt bad, but she's absolutely right. Like, what I had written was a mouthful. But God bless her, she tried. Yeah. But that was also the first script I turned it in. So you always turn it in, your writer's draft, to the bosses. So Brad and Jonathan, and they might hand back notes to your writer's draft, and then you'll revise quick. It depends on where you are in the production calendar. And then it goes out to the crew, because they need to start working. And I remember that when that script went out to crew, it was the first time I was on staff when that had happened. So I'm getting feedback in the moment, not, you know, a few weeks later, like with Learning Curve. And I remember one of my friends who was in the art department saying everyone loved this part, and everyone loved like the when O'Neill is going to unbutton Janet's top, and it's like she's just an alien. That was one of mine, and that was where having fun with it, just an alien. That was one of my favorite parts, and that's one that a lot of other people like. They just liked that aspect of it, and that's when I realized I'm not just writing for out there. I'm writing to entertain the crew. Do you know what I mean? Like these are the first people who are going to read this. They're the biggest fans of the show. You want them to respond and be surprised too.
My favorite line, and Tom Macbeth is a friend.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I will use this on him when I meet him. Mayborn, you are an idiot every
Every
day of the
day of the
week.
week.
Why couldn't you have taken one day
That might
off?
have been a Brad line, actually.
Oh, really?
Or it might have been a man, I don't know. Sometimes, I mean, the snarky, like I could not always put in the snarky again, playing it a little safe. And then Rick would always ad lib something just to make it funny and very O'Neill-y. But yes, that I think that was definitely very in character.
Absolutely.
That was perfect. Yeah.
About Rick, I had a conversation with a writer about the fact that you guys slave over these things for weeks or months beforehand. And then you want to get a line, of course, that Rick's going to go, "That's great." And often he would come in and just ad lib, and the writer said, "If you want to make it better, great. If you're changing it just to change it, that pisses me off." Can you speak to that, or was it like he's the lead of the show and he's an executive producer? He gets carte blanche.
That's interesting. I was in a unique position where I hadn't yet, again, young person, hadn't really had the hierarchy of being on set and TV. And writers today don't, I mean, this is a big part of the Writers Guild strike was we're not able to have writers who are coming up have the set experience that they need to be able to work their way up to be producers and to be showrunners. So that's really valuable. I remember being on the set, I want to say it was for Foothold, it might have been Learning Curve. And I'm sorry, I can't remember which one
You're
it
okay.
was. Maybe it was Ergo. No, it was Foothold. And Michael Greenberg had a question about changing a line. I didn't necessarily want to change it, but I didn't feel like I had permission because he's executive producer and it was like first thing in the morning. So I wanted Brad's permission to change it. Do you know what I mean? So I remember there being like, I'm not sure what I'm allowed to do.
Okay.
I don't want to step on toes.
Because
So
Michael Greenberg was, I mean, Rick would use him to, as like a go-between to get certain things done.
and I think that can be common on a lot of, I mean, it's a show built around your lead, right? So I know he'd had a whole thing with MacGyver. I think he was surprised when I met him that I'd never seen MacGyver. So I was just like, oh, okay, that guy. I don't know who this guy is. And that was okay. He looked at me when he first met me and said, you're a young one, aren't you? Yeah. But you definitely, as a writer, want that. Yeah, you're working hard. I mean, this is your creation as well. I think once actors come in, there is if it's going well, there is a symbiosis that takes place, right? Where they're creating a character and then that helps the writer bring more into that character. And you do want to know their thoughts and actors will provide perspective to things in a way because they're living in these bodies and they're thinking through the whole backstory in a way that we're not always doing it. But at the same time, we have like a long arc to put in there. So I think it should be more of a dialogue. Should it always be like, hey, you can change whatever? I think that's disrespectful. I don't remember Rick just ad-libbing everything when I was there. It was early in the show. I do remember he would ad-lib like reaction lines. And what am I going to do? I'm the baby writer, so I'm not going to say anything. And in TV writing, you don't get to get too attached. The one time I do remember it being really, really annoying was when one of the guest actors came over to tell me that he changed some of my lines because they were hard to say and I wasn't using contractions. And I was kind of going, well, you know, aliens don't use contractions in our world. It's just kind of how it works. But
that's
that
how you
was,
set them apart, like the Tolan, you know, they just don't use them.
Yeah. And that was irksome. Like you're in our house, please respect our house, and you're just a dude. So like dude number five, yes, you have your name on a roll, but please don't do that because our work is important too.
Wow.
But I didn't see that happening a lot. Rick was very Rick. This is, you know, he's the lead of the show. Most of them would ask before they changed something. Amanda, to her credit, did not ask me to change that line. We probably should have changed that line. But she tried to make it work. And I remember that she did. So I just felt bad after the fact.
But yeah, that's a complicated situation. I have been there on set. So I can definitely relate when one of the actors is going through a hard time with the dialogue and the whole cast and the set is just kind of, there's a quiet, you know, and the unit publicist came over to us and they're saying, yeah, this so-and-so is having trouble getting through this scene. And it's like, oh, you know, you kind of like, you feel bad for them, but at the same time, that's why they're there, you know, to execute something that can be complicated. So you guys pull together and you get them through it. So
to be fair, we're not going to swing it out of the park. When we're writing things, we're in charge of the story.
Yep.
We have a vision of how the story's working. And the longer that you've been on the show, the more you can channel certain people and the best TV writers are able to kind of just channel that voice. That's like the quintessential TV writer skill. And that's something I definitely have. Part of the reason I did well was because I was able to channel voices really well and perspectives.
I want to speak.
Just because it works on the page doesn't always mean it's going to work on its feet. Yeah. And so there should sometimes be an exploration like, okay, this is not, why is this not working? Sometimes that's a simple process or we need to change something here. That's why you put writers on your set. Mm. Hopefully you're not rewriting whole entire things though.
As a writer, do you, and I've never asked this to a writer, do you speak the dialogue out loud to make sure that it's going to work?
Clearly, I did not when Amanda was doing it.
That's not what I meant.
Sometimes?
Yeah.
I think it depends on the writer.
Yeah.
I basically, when I'm doing it, is I'm listening to the voices in my head.
Yeah.
And that's why TV writing to me is so much easier than film writing or original writing. It's trying to get that voice to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And Amanda's is very specific. That's also the great thing about TV. And good shows, the characters will start off and they'll be kind of stereotypical seeming. Mm-hmm. Like you have Daniel the scientist and you have O'Neill the brash guy.
They're in their lanes.
They're in their lanes. And that can be stereotypical, but the good shows will add shading on top of that where they become more than that and more dimensional. But they will still, they should be talking very distinctly with a very distinct point of view.
Mm-hmm. I had this conversation with Harley Jane Kosak, who's done, she's done a pretty good for herself in terms of as a novelist. And like when I'm writing fiction as well, you know, I'll have these characters in a situation and I'll want to go a certain way with them. And it's almost like the character says no. Like the character needs to go, the character from this perspective, from this situation, it's almost like their little self-contained personality in there basically says to me, I wouldn't do that this way. I would do it this way. And this is how I would deliver it. And then I write it out and it's like, okay, that fits better. And it's kind of like a wild situation to be in because it's like, Who am I attached to? Who am I communicating with? You know, I'm communicating with an aspect of myself that's self-contained in that situation. But if you trust the characters, they will guide you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The problem with TV, or the good part of TV, is that you're on such a clock and time is money that you don't always have the liberty to kind of sit with this and let it talk to you. Sometimes you need to get it to there. And after a certain point, you can't rewrite anything because, or anything substantial, because you're locked in on your costumes and your settings. I mean, you've done this. So you can really just kind of, either it's editing, which they call the second revision, you know, writing is also in the editing room. And sometimes you don't do well. You know, there's definitely things on episodes we would have changed. I do know, going back to Foothold, where Carter is in the plaza and Mayborn and O'Neill and Daniel are there. Brad said after we'd filmed it, he's like, she should have walked away. She should have just walked away and then changed her mind. And that would have been more powerful. And it's like, oh, yeah, that would have worked too. But
yeah.
Alas.
Absolutely. I always tried to figure out how they got there so fast. You know, I guess they took their own plane as well.
No, they took the plane that came out because they went back.
Oh, okay. So that wasn't Mayborn's plane. Okay. That was Major Davis's, because Mayborn had the same plane later on in the season. So I always associated that as Mayborn's plane, but it had to have been Major Davis's plane because he was already at Stargate Command and was flying. So there you go.
Well, the minute she calls Mayborn.
Yeah.
And that's Colorado. And okay. So, they're probably already looking for her.
Yeah.
So they're going to also be on a plane out when they hear that Mayborn's got her.
That's true. So she probably took public transit to get to DC.
Well, yeah, she can't take military stuff.
No, that's true.
No, she's flying commercial.
Yeah. This is the stuff that you got to work through. You know,
you don't got it. It's called refrigerator logic, you know, up to a certain point, and then you're like, they're aliens.
Okay. That's true. What did you think of the costumes, the props, the assets that were created for this story?
Oh my gosh.
Right?
Oh my God. And you know what was so amazing was this was Andy Makita's first episode.
Wow.
That he ever directed.
Is that right? Because he was an AD.
He was?
Wow.
This was the first one. So for me to know that now, looking back and to have seen his work in so many other incarnations, I mean, to have this as your first episode and knock it out of the park, especially with all the technical stuff we threw at him, as like the special effects with the blurring. And I remember standing in the kitchen and him telling me, you know, when they're shifting from the alien to the person, it's going to be this blur, like, and he's like, what do you think? And he was really hoping for my approval. And I'm kind of like, sure. Like, whatever you want to do. Cause I didn't know, again, I'm staying in my lane. So just what he came up with. And this is also the thing with working in TV outside of like plays or novels, is just the teamwork that goes into all of those episodes and how deeply every department thinks about what they are doing and their craft. I mean, costumes, that long braid that Marin had in Learning Curve, Jan was makeup.
Newman? Oh, okay.
She was makeup, right?
Christina McQuarrie costuming?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I remember there being a rationale behind this, that they had a narrative for why the clothes look like that.
Yeah, the Urons had their student like look. It was like almost like their uniforms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they think about that. That's not something I gave them. This is kind of why I like, and this is my difficulty in going from scripts to prose, is suddenly you kind of have to explain some of that. And for someone who was trained, like my first writing training was screenwriting. So 43 pages, 1 hour long story. This is what you can do. 4 lines of explanation, maybe, per scene. You don't have to think about all that. That's for the other departments to come up with. So that makes prose writing very intimidating and a lot of words. I just say this, like, it just feels like I'm overwriting constantly. Too many words.
So, and that's, I wanted to bring back up the plane.
The plane.
So when your writing, I guess, it was the plane introduced to you in like the first draft phase so that you could solve the issue of revealing how to cut through their defense systems by the change of pitch with the plane leveling off? Was that when that? Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Was definitely an outline. Yeah. So helpful. Thank you. I think we had had the idea of how are we going to overcome this? Because again, the two devices, how do we interrupt it? The thinking, because they also have to mind read. Like, what do we need the device to accomplish? And then how are we going to be able to explain that to an audience and have our characters figure it out without an exposition dump? Mm-hmm. Because the most boring thing is someone coming on and saying, you know, this is how it works.
Yeah, show, don't tell.
Right. And so that was the way to do it in that story was really a great opportunity to have it come about organically. Although shooting a gun in a plane, bad idea.
Yeah. I would say so. At least Mayborn's a good shot. So
thank goodness. Yeah.
Jeez.
Oh, wait, didn't Carter shoot?
She could have.
She shot him the first time because that was also like
Mayborn shot too. Mayborn, when one of them tried to get up, he was like, sit down. That's the one that I was thinking of. But yeah, no, absolutely.
No, I think Carter, because Carter grabs the sidearm and
kills, I think, Major Davis.
And kills O'Neill.
Oh, O'Neill. Okay.
No, she kills O'Neill because the. Okay. I want to say that now.
Probably.
But I'm going to say that my thought process, I remember it being, how can we get Carter to shoot him?
Yeah.
Like, you want to see your characters be in situations that we haven't seen them in before, because that is the joy of hanging out with these characters, is what new things are they going to do today? This is why I watch TV every week, is to see how the characters are going to stick to their type and how we're going to try to shove them off balance.
Yeah.
And what they're going to do and what we think they're going to do and the anticipation of that is joyful. And then sometimes being a little surprised. And I don't think anyone would say, well, Sam Carter's going to shoot Jack O'Neill in this episode. Going to shoot him next.
Not knowing what he is really yet.
No,
you know?
But taking the chance that, like, she's trusting herself that this guy is, this is not Jack O'Neill that she knows.
Yeah. Yeah. That's wild. I never thought of it that way before. My other favorite line from this, and I'm curious if it was an ad lib or if you put this one in there. And every time I go to the
me. No,
every time I go to the doctor's office now, I'm about to get the jab for whatever reason. I tell them, you know,
really
just
stick it in,
really jam it in their heart.
Jam it in. That was Rick. That was Rick.
That is so good, you know. But you know, you can take credit for these things. That's the other side of it. If they ad lib something good,
I have some moss growing in some very dark places. I do believe that was mine. And let me say, the hypercane scenario, like unfortunately the one that just hit Acapulco last week. We are now in that. I remember reading that in Discover magazine. I think at the time I was again huge science geek. How can we bring in these science concepts? That was what started Learning Curve, was the nanites.
Yep.
So I remember telling Brad about the hypercane. And he said, well, I kind of want to keep that as a possible setting for later. And there was probably also budget. Like, we don't want to do all that and aliens in the same thing. But now we got it.
Wow.
So in our world. So I think about that every single time.
I can imagine not wanting to overload on your concepts, you know.
Oh, yeah. No, you don't want to. Yeah.
You want to make sure that everything has room to breathe.
And simple is better.
Yeah.
Hanging up those actors, that was when Don Davis, I love that man. I remember having a conversation with him early on. He was describing getting a script and just, he had this Southern, slight Southern drawl. And the way he described things, I looked at him and said, Don, where did you grow up? Where are you from originally? He was from Southern Missouri. I said, you talk like my dad.
Yeah.
And who had also grown up in the similar region. So that was kind of neat. He was very much that understated kind of guy. But he turned to me on the Foothold set when in between being strung up on wires. And said, sometimes I just don't know what goes through these writers' minds of yours. Sorry.
And Rick accidentally bumps him. He's like, sorry, General. That's so funny.
Oh, it was really an opportunity to just kind of have be a little bit silly and something that was really, it was really serious. But it there were those moments that were really fun.
And the way that Andy shot that, I mean, it looks like you guys, that they're like two or three stories off the ground. And they're still, you know, they're still dangly, but they're not that high. You know?
Oh no, they are. They were up.
They were that high? I thought that they were pretty close to like 6 or 7 or 8 feet from the ground.
No, they were not.
Ooh.
No, they were not. I mean, maybe they got lowered at some point to make it more.
That's probably photos that I've seen. Okay.
Yeah, because when I walked in there, I remember them being up.
Wow.
So maybe it was a cover shot.
Yeah.
But yeah, they did a phenomenal job. Set deck did. Oh my goodness. And then costume. KY Jelly.
Yeah.
Just rip it all over them. Let's make him a little bit more miserable.
Oh, absolutely. It's nice and gooey. He looks gooey. That gooey is always alien.
And then just stand there or just hang there with these harnesses that are very uncomfortable for half an hour. I mean, yeah.
Oh man.
No one knifed my tires. Now I'm starting to wonder why. They were very nice people.
Yeah, absolutely. They're getting paid to do that now. Come on.
Was it enough, though? Was it enough? Those poor people.
I think that, you know, had you had more time, I mean, this is Showtime, no limits, right? You could have gone in some interesting directions with that. But it's a family show.
Family show. Absolutely. Family show.
Any other notes on Foothold before we move on?
Oh, my gosh. So many. But no, I think that's... Oh, there was supposed to be alien language. I wrote a whole alien language. That was like a day of work. And then Brad was like, no, we're not going to write alien language. It's going to sound silly. And he was right. So they kind of just did sound effects.
Yolo.
Yeah, that was a much better choice.
Well, not everyone has to talk like we do, you know? Not everyone has to have normal moving mouths. So yeah, it was such a departure.
Yeah, there are evil aliens, and they may not come. They may come back, and we don't know. Maybe they're still here somewhere. That was definitely open ended at the end for a reason.
Absolutely, I want to jump into some fan questions, and then we'll come back to some more. So we're getting quite a list here, and I'm like, I'm not going to meet these guys. If you and I have to break until, you know, season 4 next year, come back and talk some more. I hope you're cool with that.
I'm totally cool.
But I want to get the fans' questions in.
Of course.
Lock Watcher, I've not read these. During your time as a story editor in season 3, were there any interesting storylines that you had to fix? Plot holes, changes, any challenging episodes? First of all, before you answer that, can you give me a rundown of the role of story editor?
Yes, I can, because I think that it's not editing. It has nothing to do with editing. It's a title that you get when you're on a show. And these were set by the Guild long before my time. So it's staff writer is the base. So if you're hired as staff writer, and it also determines salary levels according to the Guild. So staff writer, you're hired on, you're paid a weekly salary for all these staff level positions, but you're also, it depends on how you're compensated for scripts. So you get a certain minimum level of weekly salary, and then you get a certain script fee. So their staff writer, they brought me on as story editor because I was moving to Vancouver just after 2 weeks. So this was kind of a sweeten the pot kind of deal, because it's hard to get someone to up and move out of the country, even though it's next door, to take a job. So that was why I came on at that level. But it was seriously baby writer. So most of the revisions were Brad and Jonathan and Robert as the senior level writers. And the showrunners on most shows, it's either going to be the executive producer or the supervising producer who is going to handle all of that on the day-to-day.
Okay.
So were there anything that we did? I don't think there was.
Okay.
We would meet in a room to discuss stories and breaking down stories. We were not necessarily privy to the whole behind the scenes, like the budget and script fixes and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, we had Brad on The Companion in a 90-minute episode a few weeks ago, and he was saying, like, one of the jobs of being up the top is, you know, is doing tweaks and rewrites to bring the character's tones into focus, and, mm-hmm. you know, you don't share the byline for that. That's your job. So, you know, unless I'm sure there was, like, a serious, severe rewrite, then that's something else. But, yeah.
I mean, there were. I know that there was one script that came in that was not from a freelancer, because at that time you were still bringing on freelancers. You have 22 episodes a year. Now it's more like 10 or 13 episodes, so they don't do this. But 22 episodes, you would bring in freelancers a couple times, and the scripts were not always up to the level of the show. And what, I mean, also things change on the fly. So mm-hmm. I could have been in the middle of a script, and I'm sure I was a couple of times, and then Brad would come in and say, hey, in two episodes, we're going to be doing this thing. So you need to change your thing. That's very common. That's why in TV, you don't get too attached. But one thing I really loved about Brad, and I appreciated it, and put him and Jonathan above a lot of other exec producers, they never took credit. Partially because your credit is what determines how much you get paid. So if you're going to share credit on an episode, you're getting half your paycheck and half your residuals. But he said to me, because I asked him, are you going to take half the credit on the script that you basically had to rewrite from page one? And he said, no, I'm not going to, because I wouldn't want someone to do that to me, and I'm not going to do that to someone else. I mean, they were really fantastic people in charge of a show, and they were great to learn from. I think they were very, it was the most anti-psychotic, which is, that's not the word I'm looking for. It was the most non-toxic environment mm-hmm. in terms of writing, in terms of Hollywood, that I could possibly have been working in. And we were going home every night at 5 or 6.
Yeah.
That's nuts. We had regular working hours. No one has regular working hours in Hollywood, but we did. And that was a testament to how well run the show was behind the scenes. I'm sure Brad and Jonathan were working after hours, but still, they made sure that we had time.
They made it look much easier.
Yeah, they took on a lot of the tasks. They were very good at time management and making sure the trains were running on time and getting crew that was also up to the task of making sure it ran well. Mm-hmm. But that takes a lot of effort. And then it's not just those two guys. And I don't think they would tell you it was just them. It's an entire crew that works together really well and is really respectful of each other.
Absolutely. Emily Cheatham. What did you enjoy most about your involvement in Stargate when looking back? If you could delineate that.
There's so much.
Yeah.
It's led to some amazing things in life. I mean, I got one of my teaching jobs from Stargate. Bless you. I went to be a community college teacher, and I keep writer on my resume because there's a skill set there.
Of course.
And he said, oh, like a novel or something. And I just said Stargate SG-1. I don't know if you've heard of it, because it's been a while now, right? And that got me the job. Well, I had the job, but that associate dean, I didn't know, was like the biggest Stargate SG-1 fan.
Wow.
In the world. So he, like, from then on, like, oh my gosh. So the occasional fangirling, fanboying that still comes up mm-hmm. is fun. And I enjoy that, and being able to meet a lot of different people because of it, and just having, dude, I got to write TV that is out there. And I'm more in the mystery, like the book world now, just in terms of my involvement with writers. And this is what a lot of people aspire to. They're still working to do this, and I had it happen, if that makes sense. So yeah.
Early on in your career.
So yeah. That was a blessing and a curse. And I'm finally in a place where I can recognize it as, like, it happened and it was fantastic. That doesn't mean it has to be the rest of my life. I can go do other things. But what a great opportunity. Plus the things like meeting Peter DeLuise, which
right.
you should ask me about, because that was fun times.
Heather, and what was it like meeting Peter DeLuise?
You want to do more fan questions, or you want to?
I do want to get to this because I don't want to lose track of it, and I'll come back around to those fans down the mountain. They'll get theirs.
We can talk to them later.
I did want to know this.
Peter was directing on the show when I was there. I think later he became a writer producer on the show. And I met him for the first time, and this is not too far out from 21 Jump Street. I think we're talking like a decade.
Yep.
And I met him on set, and I said, you know, I was a huge fan of 21 Jump Street. This is how I got started in TV, et cetera, et cetera. I worked for Bill Nuss, and a little bit of fangirling there. And so I had my mom go through my stuff back at home, and she sent me the postcard that he'd signed and sent to me when I was a teenager, and had written him fan mail. And so I brought this to set, and I said, here, look, I found this, you know, you sent this to me 10 years ago. He said, oh yeah, I didn't sign that.
Oh,
like his fan club had sent this out. He had people to do that. And I just looked at him. I'm like, screw you. Like I was 14 years old. Come on. You just crushed my dreams. I was being silly. And then I went to my mailbox the next day, and he had an 8x10 headshot with Love and Wet Kisses, Peter DeLuise, in my mailbox, made out to me. And it was hysterical and funny, and just kind of, if teenager me had known that two of my episodes were going to be directed by Peter DeLuise.
Yeah.
I mean, oh my God. Right. So I think that was really cool. And what was also really cool was he is really a nice guy. You know, they say don't meet your heroes, but really generous, really a stand-up guy. If you had family visiting while he was directing an episode, he would make them, he wouldn't make them. He would invite them to be in shots. Mm-hmm. So that's how my mother ended up in Ergo as a tech, because she was visiting Vancouver the week that Dom DeLuise was on, playing Ergo.
Wow.
And that was really cool because my mom had always been a Gene Wilder fan. So she has seen all of the Mel Brooks movies, all of them, and was a big fan of Dom DeLuise. So we both got to meet him.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And, yeah, really sweet guy. Really fantastic. So that was, you know, hanging out with really creative, interesting people.
Yeah.
Who were also good people. I think that was one of the great things about Stargate as well.
No, Peter is very special. He's always surprises you. So I completely get that's a great story.
Yeah. It was I just that never happens, right? Like the connections that you make early on, and you never know where life is going to lead. And that just really, you couldn't write it any better than that.
Mm-hmm. Kappa 1611. Is sci-fi your favorite genre to write in, or do you prefer to be flexible in terms of like more fantasy or more hard grounded fiction? What's your poison?
Brain sucking.
Brain sucking. Good old brain
sci-fi,
sucking.
Right?
Yeah.
I think it is sci-fi. Going back to your original question about being a woman in television at the time, I took several meetings where they would say, wow, you're the only woman writing sci-fi. And I would say, oh, okay, well, I must know the other eight because there's more than me. And we still talk about that during the writer's strike. A friend of mine was on a strike line that was the sci-fi writers. I think it was actually the women sci-fi writers for now. And it was over 100. It was like a couple hundred women. And someone had posted the first strike in 2007 that had about eight people. And I knew six of them personally were my friends, and saying, look at how much we've grown. And it's true, but that eight was not necessarily representative at the time either. It was probably a couple dozen. And it's certainly a myth that is pervasive to this day. I'm a grad student at a talk I gave at a film school who said she was getting into television writing because there weren't any women. And I went, I'm sorry, what? Like, there's tons of women out there. Are they all getting hired? Not necessarily. Is there still like the boys' club mentality? Some places, yeah. I do like seeing that the Directors Guild has made an overt effort into making sure that a certain amount of episodes are directed by women. And not limiting it to, oh, the you can only write children, you can only write family, you can only write the gooey, mushy stuff, because that doesn't interest me.
No, go nuts.
No, and
Yeah.
like The Night Manager with Tom Hiddleston and Olivia Colman, I was just rewatching that, and that's Suzanne Beer who directed those episodes, and that is as kick-ass and action-oriented as you can get, and I just love it. So that's definitely what I gravitate toward, is very character-oriented stories. And I think normal people in extraordinary circumstances. And how do they act, and maybe how would they act differently than we might expect?
Absolutely. I think that's what Stephen King does so well. You know, it's like, okay, here's a person and here's this extraordinary situation and go. And it's like,
Right.
wow. You can
Well,
really turn ugly if you need to, you know, or whatever the situation may be.
he talks about like it's not the thing that's out there that's scary, it's the thing that's in your house. It's not right. I don't think I'm Stephen King in any way, shape, or form, but definitely always the question of what are the motivations of this person and how can we bring that out in a different way.
For sure. Pamela Terechek, as a woman, do you think the guys in the writing room wrote Sam and Janet well? And in retrospect, was there anything that you might have tweaked or changed? And if so, what? I wouldn't have thought to ask this one, so thank you, Pamela.
I love these questions because it's always like people who've been wondering for a long time,
Right.
and we don't know to wonder this or not. I don't recall there being any. I mean, they created these characters, right? So and they were good writers, so I don't think that there was. I do believe that Brad and Jonathan have kind of like walked back that whole, I'm just as good as you are from the pilot.
Yes, for sure. And just because my sexual reproductive organs are on the inside instead of the outside doesn't mean I can't handle whatever you can handle. Yeah.
Right. But on the other hand, I mean, this is not the cop out. It sounds like the 90s were different. We were in a
Yeah.
different era, however many years ago that was. So we can't really be held to the standards of today. The fact that we had women in action roles was kind of different at the time. We might have done more casting of women, and thinking back, like we did have a lot of secondary characters who were cast as women in New Ground. The second in command of the aliens was
Correct.
male in the first version that I wrote, and she was cast as female, as actually a couple of them were. So I think that that was starting, and I know that they were always very aware of that. So I didn't, I never ran into sexism on that show, in the way that I know a lot of other people were experiencing it at that time.
Awesome to hear. Yeah, no, it's for so long it was a male dominant industry, and you know there just wasn't, for
It
whatever,
still is,
yeah.
unfortunately. But I mean, it's better. Is it completely better? No. And I think even in society, we still have this tendency toward the great man syndrome that we see in business or anything. Like, oh, they're brilliant because they're in charge of things. No, they're brilliant. They're in charge because they had a whole lot of money and they take credit for other people's work. And we still need to see a lot more advancement in people of color being involved, and people who are not the gender binary being involved, and seeing those stories being represented in our science fiction and in our art. I still don't think we've reached a good level of that, or even women's stories. I think that what's interesting to me is to see more voices coming in and watching things that I may not understand, but then again, it's like I'm not the target audience for this. They're not talking to me, and that's totally fine. I don't need to understand every reference that's in here. And that doesn't lessen the experience for me at all.
No, but I can watch a show like Hunger Games or Alien, and I can follow a female heroine and still feel perfectly compatible with the story. I mean, that's maybe just me. But I mean, I can still, connect on a human level to a character, regardless of their gender. Having said that, I love episodes where Sam and, Janet get to kick ass, like in Hathor. So that second half of that episode is solid, and it's all the women on the base. So for
And
sure.
I think it even comes out better to bring this back to Rite of Passage, which I know we're going to talk about later, but I really recognized seeing the episode, and I had emailed you last night to say, oh my gosh, I did not realize how true to the writer's draft the final product was. So that was nice. What the rewrite really did was it was very O'Neill centered initially. So it was almost retreading a lot of learning curve, I think, in terms of this is a child that is in danger, and O'Neill, the dad, is going to be invested. And when Brad rewrote that, I'm assuming Brad rewrote that, when he did his revision, he really made it more centered on Janet and
Sam.
Sam and the daughter. And I think that that was really great in terms of the relationship. I
These are
think
her
that
surrogate parents.
exactly. And Jack was in there too,
Of
but it
course.
makes sense that Sam would be more at the forefront. And I don't remember if we'd established that initially, but this was season five. So they definitely have places where they're going to take this story that I was not privy to because I left the show at the end of three. So I really liked seeing that, and looking back, I totally get why you would do that, make that creative decision. Like that really deepened it in a way.
Absolutely. There is a quibble over a story element
Ooh, okay.
that I was running into earlier when we were talking about learning curve, because you said that they were lobotomized now. And I'm curious as to your take on this. So Peace Writer says, so was the line there now they will now taught the old be taught the old-fashioned way, not in your original script. Because Kalen says, Colonel O'Neill, this is my son Tommen. I am teaching him. All of the past Uron children will now learn in the old-fashioned way, as you might say. He will know all that you have done for Orban. So in this version, it does suggest that their brains aren't permanently broken. Yeah, right. Yeah, no, I mean, it's a
Yeah,
lot of
they were lobotomized in my version.
yeah. Okay.
They
Yeah.
were.
I
I
would have
did. And
preferred that, you know? I think I would have
I.
modern version of it, I would have preferred that.
And you know what? That might have been a studio note. That might have been like, we cannot, as a studio, advocate lobotomizing small children.
Yeah, that makes a
That
lot
would
of
make
sense.
it would make sense. Like, do we really want to? They were a lot different back then. Like,
This was the 90s.
I remember when you were not allowed to put a gun anywhere near someone's head at all. You could not do this, much less everything we see now. Like
Yeah.
that was a line you did not cross, and now it's everywhere. Also, barfing. Can we talk about barfing on television and film? I would like that to be a red line again. I don't want to see that anymore.
Oh, yeah, that's it. There are certain things that it's like, really? Do we have to go there? Is that necessary? Yeah.
And
It
it seems we go there gratuitously a lot. There are certain places, like if you're watching The Americans, going there makes sense. But in other places, I think you don't need that. You don't need it to be so in your face and concrete.
As a writer, do you think that a lot of where we have gone now is just over the hill in terms of shock value? Let's do
Yes.
this because it will get clicks and people will be talking about it and it will trend.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is not to say I am certainly not one who, like, personally, I don't like gore. Never been my thing. I was not
Me
allowed to
neither.
watch horror movies growing up at all.
No torture porn.
I don't like to, I draw the line at torture porn. I draw the line at, I cannot do like True Detective, gratuitous violence against women. I can't do it anymore. The whole fridging women thing, or the, you know, another woman is dead and this is what launches our story. I would like to see different things. I think a lot of it is the people who are in charge of the entertainment and the distributors, the studios, the networks. It's not always up to the creator, but there are some creators who that's kind of their go-to, and that's their story. And that's kind of, I think, encouraged in a way as well, that people think edgy is gross. And people think that if we don't explain things, or we don't show the audience exactly what's going on, they're not going to be able to follow it. You know, you have to say everything. Your subtext has to be text. And I don't think that that's true. I think our audiences are much smarter than that. And you know what? A little bit of suggestion and questions is, and quibbles is part of what makes it fun. You don't need to have everything solved or answered.
I think that gratuitous sex, I think it's like, okay, we get it. Where does the story go from here? You know?
There
So.
was just a story, an article out, and I have just read the headline, probably because it was clickbait or clickbaity, but saying that young people today are tired of seeing sex in their media. In terms of like just showing sex is not something they want to see, but they do want to see the whole spectrum of relationships. They want to
Right.
see
Don't
platonic
just plug
relationships.
that. Yeah.
Right. It's not about the sex, it is
Yeah.
about the connection. They want to see it in all its forms, all its genders, all its expressions. And I think that that is true of most people. It's not just the young ones, but I think the young people are definitely leading the charge on it doesn't have to be binary, and studios following that.
No, that's, I think that that's a legitimate point for sure.
Yeah, it's not something we could have done in the 90s, I don't think. I think that that's the explosion of streaming allowed that to happen, where we had a whole lot more voices, because you needed to fill this, what was it, 500 something shows when you have to find a lot of different writers. So that gave a platform to a lot of different voices that we hadn't heard from before. At the same time, those are the first ones that were cut when the strike came through, that the studios used that as a reason to say, oh, sorry. Yeah. Your rating's out of here.
Oh God, jeez. Gate Gabber, my producer, Linda Gate Gabber Fury, wants to know, were you
Hello,
ever
Linda.
asked to give an actor a line reading of a difficult line? Like line reading equals, this is how, like, just
Not my
say
job.
this.
That's the director's job.
Oh, okay. She said, when I took directing in college, my professor said to never give a line reading unless asked. Is that as true in TV as it seems to be in theater?
I'm not allowed to do that. I am the writer, not the director. The director is the boss on the set. The writer is the boss of the story, but there is a hierarchy for a reason. Just like, you know, you have your lead grips and your first AD. Everyone has a job, and any TV writer you ask, there are certain rules when you're on set, and one of them, even other actors, you do not give notes to anyone without going through the director first.
Okay.
Do I
Absolutely.
wish that they'd read it a different way sometimes? Sure.
Yeah. But
Not
stay in
my
your
job.
lane.
My lane is over here.
That's fair.
And I end up marrying a director. So that in particular was a lesson learned. Just and if we work together on a set, and we have, I am not in charge because he is the director. Full stop. It makes things so much easier in the world when you have that through line that you it's necessary for production.
Of course, yeah. As long as there are doors are open in appropriate times and places to be able to take that person and say, I've got th this. This is rattling around in my head. What do you think? You know? So.
Well, ideally it should be a collaboration. Like
Yeah.
and that was part of Greenberg's job too, was television is a rotating door of directors who are coming in. Not everyone has been with the show or has seen the show. They may not know the voice of the show. So that is really the job of the on-set producer, is to say, hey, that's not something they would do, or because the actor also, it's not necessarily their job to say, that's not something I would do.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Okay. So like, they're also there to defend the characters as much as well as the actors are. Okay. Wow.
The idea is that at that time we had, I think, 8 days to shoot. Again, not a lot of time. Really goes quickly. So you want to smooth that process as much as possible. So there are endless meetings before you get to shooting any episode, like tone meetings, and you've made all these decisions ahead of time. So if anything's going to get changed on set, that's going to take up time. You want to reduce that as much as possible. So
makes
that
a lot of
is,
sense.
Yeah, that is the purpose of everybody being there.
Okay. Philippe Canot, did you see Stargate Universe and would you have liked to have written for it?
I watched Stargate Universe, I think with my kids one night, the pilot.
Uh-huh.
Because it's back on streaming.
Yep.
And I said, hey, this is pretty good. But have I continued watching Stargate? I have not. Part of that was because we were in the time of the VCR back then. And
right.
Just, we were on direct, and then it was DirecTV and TiVo. I was one of the first TiVo people. But still, there was a limit to how much you could record, and I was still a working TV writer, and I had to watch a whole bunch of TV. I wasn't going to be writing for Stargate again, but I felt like I had a good handle on Stargate, you know, where if I needed some episodes, they'd send them to me. But I had to keep up with other TV. And then there's so much TV out there, you know.
You can't see it all. You got to be selective.
I've tried. It doesn't work.
I know. And, you know, I have a specific room in my house that I do my dedicated, like scripted TV viewing. But then when I'm on my phone and I'm just having lunch, I want to watch Below Deck Med. You know, I want to watch something stupid. Give me my, that is my dirty little secret, is Below Deck Mediterranean. I'm a huge Captain Sandy fan. So
I do not critique any, and I've taught TV writing, I've taught TV history, and I always ask, like, what's your guilty pleasure show? We do not judge what people do in their downtime. You watch whatever makes you happy.
Mm-hmm.
If it's got to be stupid and like, it's like me, like reading Cosmopolitan magazine. That's what I used to do. After I finished a script, I needed to empty my brain as quickly as possible. I went out and bought the newest edition.
Well, you have to have a palate cleanser, you know, so that you can come back in and be like, okay, you know, I'm resetting now back to baseline.
Right.
No, I think that, I absolutely. So, I didn't nearly get to everything that I wanted to with you, Heather. I thought it was important to get the fan questions in, but we have New Ground Beneath the Surface and Rite of Passage still to discuss. And I know you've been doing your research for these episodes. In the last like 5 minutes that I have with you, is there anything that you want to bring up that you've discovered in going through the content fresh before we call it a day? Because I do want to bring you back next season, next year, to discuss those episodes in detail. This has been fantastic. I don't know about you, but I have loved this.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad. It's always fun to revisit something because it was a long time ago. It was such a positive experience, no matter how much anxiety I brought to it. Because it's a big job, and it was important.
It's your first big show.
Do well. Yeah, and just to be on something that was so well run and with people who were really committed to being true to the science. I mean, Brad and Jonathan didn't, the science that we did on that show was as correct as it could be. Tetrachloroethylene is a real substance. I did not make that up. Yes, I can pronounce it. I was not as good at the mythology aspect, but Chalchihuitlike was a real god, and I had to call a university to get the pronunciation of that we put in the script. And I did get a phone call from set saying, how do you know that's how you pronounce it? And I said, because I talked to this person who has researched it, and they said it was this way.
There you
go.
So
they were always on point with the research. The Air Force, we had a technical advisor. Mm. One of the biggest compliments I got from him was that I had depicted something very accurately, which I appreciated, because you don't want any of your fans in the know to get turned off and taken out of the story because they're fans too, and you want to make them have a good time.
Of course, you know, this is your first audience, so
right. So it was great, and it's always fun to kind of revisit that period of my life, which was really tremendous. And Vancouver is still one of my favorite places in the world to be. So yeah, ask Michael Shanks. Well, he's not going to remember, but I had strep throat real bad when I was working there. I was out for a week alone in Vancouver with strep throat. We can talk about that later. But I remember seeing Mike Shanks on the set. He and his girlfriend at the time lived like next door to my building. So they were in the building next door. And he asked where I'd been. And I told him, he's like, oh, why didn't you call us? We could have brought you something. And he's like, oh, wait, you did. Because I was saying I couldn't talk. So he was like, oh, you were the one who called and hung up. So I'm like, thanks, man. That was pretty damn funny if I remember it this many years later.
Yeah, but absolutely.
That was a good
one. He's something. And yeah. This has been really cool, Heather. Thank you for sharing all of these stories. And you know, I'm no longer surprised when I sit down with people and they get to talking about a subject, and it's like it unlocks these other doors to other memories, and it's like, oh yeah, this happened too. And as fans, we eat it up.
So. Oh, absolutely. I eat it up like on other shows. I also want to know behind the scenes. So this is a ton of fun. Thanks for having me today.
Thank you for being here. I will be emailing you to figure things out for when we come back, probably around March. And we'll get you back in the seat and we'll talk some more.
All right. I'll do some more research so I'll be prepared.
You were great. Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
Be well.
I'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Heather Ash, story editor for Stargate SG-1. I am privileged to have so many of these amazing people in to do this oral history project, and this episode did not disappoint. Michael Shanks is going to be joining us in 20 minutes for the season finale of Dial the Gate. We started off at GateCon last August, September in 2022, and finally I get a break. So I love y'all, but you know what? Me needs some rest, so I'm going to Panama. So I really hope you enjoyed this episode, and I think Michael's going to be pretty amazing as well. My thanks to my moderating team, Tracy, Anthony, Summer, Jeremy. You guys have been tremendous this entire season. My producer, Linda Gate Gabber Fury, and Frederick Marcoux at Concepts Web. He keeps dialthegate.com up and running. And we will be seeing you momentarily for Michael and the finale of the show. My name is David Reed for Dial the Gate, and I will see you on the other side. Dial the Gate is hosted and executive produced by David Reed. The producer is Darren Sumner. Co-produced by Linda Fury. The composer is Neil Acree. Animations by Bryce Orrs. The production assistant is Jennifer Kirby. Moderators include Summer Roy, Keith O'Mell, Tracy Noller, Jeremy Heiner, Reese M., and Anthony Rowling. Logo design by Deborah J. Bell. Additional effects by Thomas Tots, with contributions by model makers Chris Baker, Stephen Barr, Kevin Zabo, and Tom Paris. The archivists are Linda Fury, Zachary Adams, and Fred Eric Marcoux. For general inquiries for submissions, please contact us at dialthegateshow@gmail.com. Visit our website for the upcoming schedule, as well as an archive of our past episodes at dialthegate.com.